Okay, straddling the news, your voice, your community. We're in conversation with Brian Lacey, Julian Cunningham and Sam O'Farrie, and it's about the Donegal Gay Walking Group. And Sam, I just wanted to pick you up, if that's all right, in a comment you made in relation to, do you know, feeling that maybe you have to check yourself or your mannerisms or how you speak or whatever it is. I don't want to misquote you, but I think that's a decent paraphrase. I just wonder if sometimes it feels like we're going backwards in that regard. With recent events, with the sort of the feeling that people feel now empowered to say whatever they like about what, you know, about anyone, regardless of the consequences. Have we gone backwards?
I think it's sort of hard to judge. We were definitely in a honeymoon period there after the referendum. And speaking personally, I didn't believe the results of the referendum until they came through. Even though I campaigned, the marriage equality referendum, I didn't dare let myself hope because I'd seen too much of both sides growing up. The support, yes, not as much as I would have liked, and the sort of just hate. I do think that politics and the political climates have gotten much more polarized in recent years. We seem to import a lot of culture war rhetoric from the States and from the UK that doesn't fit neatly in Irish tongues, I think, but nevertheless is gaining traction here. And part of that is seeing any sort of representation of queerness, which to me as a queer person is just about like being included in conversations and in stories that we often weren't for very long. But seeing that as inherently political and as for being one team or the other, and that polarization, I think, is dragging us, at least slowing progress. I do think the majority of Irish people and the majority of people in Donegal are sound. And I think soundness is all anyone ever is all any of us really want. Let live and let live. Let people be who they want, who they are, and live freely, whether that's about your sexuality, your national identity, anything else. But there are places in Ireland that I would have felt safer, you know, holding hands in public than I do now. Unfortunately, I will say in Donegal, I feel safer holding hands in public with my boyfriend than I would have a few years ago. I think that Donegal is still a very good place to be. Mm-hmm. And the challenges facing the queer community in Donegal are challenges facing all communities in Donegal, is that we are far from the centre, underfunded, and have a lack of resources because we are people from Donegal, and that's unfortunately just how the government treats our county.
Yeah.
So we're part of it, which is good.
And Julian, you know, I don't want to get overly political on this, and I'm on social media, but I don't think I'm in an echo chamber as such. I don't think I am, so I do like to sort of get a sense of what other people are talking about. And the one thing I did find is sort of particularly the leaders of the, I don't know whether you'd call it far right or anti woke or whatever way. I'm not labelling anyone, but I'm just trying to help identify those that we're talking about. I'm thinking of your Joey Bartons, your Lawrence Foxes, and you know numerous others celebrating Leo Varadkar stepping down yesterday as if this was a victory in pushing back against sort of progression and the woke agenda. And that's happening in plain sight. It's not in secret Telegram groups. These are to accounts with multi-million euro followings. Is that, I mean, clearly you'd feel, Julian, would you, that that's regressive and regrettable?
Yeah, it certainly is disappointing. I guess social media is a double-edged sword. It allows people to connect and do very positive things, and it also gives a platform for people to say unpleasant things. But I think we just have to maximize the positives, and really I think it's, from a personal point of view, I find it very draining getting dragged into sort of negative conversations on social media that there's very little to be gained, I think, from engaging in that.
I agree, because you know what, and I don't either, and I perhaps was guilty of in the past of doing, because what you have effectively is you've got a small, very small percentage of the population using the like of X. They generally have very extreme views and are not really representative, I don't think, of the views of the 85, 90% of people in the middle. So why get your head into that space? That's me speaking about how I deal with it now.
And you won't change their mind either?
No, and they won't change each other's minds. Yeah, that's just, they're stuck in it.
Before, so can I just say, yes, on a positive note,
no, I was going to go back to that, but better. If you don't mind, I want to come back to that, but I just want to give Brian an opportunity because he did talk about yesterday and it being historic, and I want to get back to this group too because it's got 350 members, which I think is remarkable. But Brian, and you can choose not to, do you have anything to say on that?
on the comments about Leo Varadkar.
I suppose his elevation to that office and the history behind that, whichever you feel, Brian.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't agree with Leo on a lot of things, but I was delighted when there was the election of a gay teacher. It's not the only one. I mean, the Cathaoirleach of the Shannon is a gay, openly gay married man. We now have gay ministers in both the Dublin government and the Belfast government. So, that's great. And I mean, quite frankly, Leo didn't become Taoiseach because he was gay. I don't think that's really an aspect. It was an historic thing when it happened. But I think we're beyond that now. And I mean, a few people kind of get excited. Well, what of it? You know, I'm not going to get too worked up about it either way myself.
And you're right too. Right, so Julian, back to this group. And the reason I went down that road was I just hope we're not heading in a direction whereby we need even more sort of places that people might feel safe or what have you. And maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree. But in any case, just very interesting to get all of your views. Are you surprised at the success of this group? Because it's not just local people too. You have people travelling in, don't you, to join up with the events?
Yes, we have people come from sort of from Derry, from around Enniskillen, sometimes from Belfast, sometimes from Carrick and Cross. We have a guy that joins us regularly from Sligo. People do come, and a lot of people say they wish that they had something similar closer to where they are. Donegal's a beautiful place, so they think it's worth the journey.
Yeah, but you walk outside of the county as well. You organise trips away and stuff?
Yes. So in terms of walks, we try to keep them within driving distance. We've walked in Sligo at Glenith Horseshoe, Gorton Glen in County Fermanagh or Tyrone. I'm not sure which one that is. But also I did try and organise a holiday in Spain last year, but only myself and one other person went, so it didn't quite
take off.
It was
overly ambitious, perhaps, but maybe next year. You'll have
it was a lovely walking holiday. I had a great time.
Oh, you did go. You did go.
Excellent.
I did go,
yeah. Can I just pay a tribute
to
Julian?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Julian is a wonderful organiser. If anybody's looking for an organiser for anything, I would suggest contact Julian. I actually described him on occasion as a bit of a witch because he organised a climb of Errigal. I think it was January last year. And Errigal was absolutely covered in snow on a Saturday. And magically, there was no snow at all on Sunday for the walk. So
you just contact the caretaker and turn on the heaters overnight.
Yeah, that's it. Sam, can I ask you this? Just because I'll read it off air, so it's no harm mentioning it on air, and it gives people a better understanding. I have two gay children myself. Why have people gone back to referring to gay people as queers or referring to themselves as queers? In my day, it was a derogatory term. So why are we using it again, Sam? I know you used it a couple of times, so no harm just to reference that.
Thank you, Greg. I'm actually really grateful for the opportunity to talk about this because terminology is always a shifting thing. So first of all, there is a generational difference, and the older people who experience that word as more of a slur might be less inclined to use it. However, there is a distinction between queer as an adjective and queers as in calling someone a queer, seems to be what your caller in is talking about. First of all, no one has to use any terminology that they don't want to. For me, LGBTQIA is a very long mouthful, and queer sort of just encapsulates that. It's a shorthand for all of that, kind of just outside this sort of cishet norm, which is fine. It's also been used, it started out being used in academia in the late 80s, early 90s, and then made its way into mainstream use via there. So it has been around for a long time as a sort of reclaimed word. And so I just use it as a shorthand for inclusivity. But I do understand that for some people, they're hearing a slur. In the same way, when I was growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, gay was the slur. Everything was gay. It was used as a synonym for a word that I won't repeat here. It was just the worst word you could call anything. So like, it's unfortunately because the insults change, the terminology change as well. I would take this opportunity, though, to say that the queer Irish-speaking community, of which there are many, have coined their own term, which is atchach, from the word atch, which means odd or queer. But atchach is a new word, our own word for ourselves. It has never been a slur. and it is very common in use. And even LGBTQA people in Ireland who maybe don't use Irish very much sometimes still use the word Aitcheach because it is a native homegrown word for a native homegrown population. And I encourage anyone who wishes to use that word to take it on themselves because there are no negative connotations to being Aitcheach.
Okay. Julian, if people want to, I mean, the group has grown. I'm not sure if it's, you know, through sort of spreading the word or simply just actually word of mouth. Started with 6 members 6 months ago. It's grown to
Yes. Not 6 months ago. We've been going for about 2 years now.
6 months later, you went from 6 to 60, and now you're 350. My apologies. I presume things are coordinated through a Facebook page. Is that a private group? Or if there are other members of the queer community, to use Sam's phrase, that want to find out more or get involved, how do they do so?
Okay, and I will sort of add, and allies as well. If you're gay friendly and want to walk with us, you're very welcome. Just do a Google search for Donegal Gay Walking Group in the search bar in Google, and you'll find the group. It is a private group, so it means that no one can see that you're a member unless they're actually already in the group. And we do that just to protect the privacy of our members. But once people are in the group, then they can see the events that they have. They can mark themselves as attending. And it just means it's very easy to manage without having to send emails and read emails because no one likes to do that anymore.
Okay. Listen, Julian, thank you very much for your time. Been lovely speaking to you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Julian Cunningham there. Sam, thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely having you on the program. Take care of yourself.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. And last but not least, Brian, thank you very much indeed. It's been lovely having you on the show. Take care of yourself. Okay, bye-bye, Brian. And that's Brian Lacey there. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. That was Your Voice, Your Community, and focusing on the Donegal Gay Walking Group. Catherine Daly says, great to hear the Gay Walking Group getting airtime. Best wishes to those lovely folks creating more positive community in Donegal. Okay, back shortly. Right, welcome back to the show. It is time for us to speak to Keely Taverna, psychotherapist, author and coach, and to answer your relationship questions. Now, these could be relationships beyond just what might seem obvious, you know, going out with people and stuff, but relationships with family and all. And often, I think, Keely, you know, and I think sometimes the bigger the family is, that's where, firstly, good morning to you. I think, you know, family's a funny one because we sort of share the same DNA as such, there's almost this presumption that we should all get on, but so often we don't.
Exactly. We don't always get on. And it's the expectation. I often tell people when we're hurt, we feel angry or betrayed, we need to check what our expectations are. And often because we have the expectation that family should be supportive, harmonious, and advocate for us, it's very difficult when reality gives us a very different message.
Yeah, and sometimes I think people can think, and this is not from my own experience, I'm just very well read, I think sometimes too that, you know, that relationship, blood relationship, let me put it that, can be abused so that people, in terms of what they think they can say to you or opine on your life, they can actually overstep a line there. There is a line, whether it's, you know, a family line or a friendship line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, when we are, and this is really an annoying example for people, I always say, what is your expectation? And is your expectation realistic? Mm. And that's uncomfortable when you get to the realization, is it realistic? It may well be, but what does your reality, because often the issue is, the problem between reality and the fantasy that we have in our minds.
I think sometimes, though, Keely, you know, like, I think a lot of the advice you might give might challenge people to sort of look at themselves first. And yet maybe by the time we sort of reach help or think we need it, we're blaming absolutely everybody else. It's the world. But sometimes this, like, if you, there's other words you could describe, but if you meet 5 Egypts in the one day, it's possible that you're the Egypt. Do you know what I mean? if you get where I'm saying.
And you know what? At a deeper level, the value in looking at ourselves is that we have the power to change that. Mm. And that puts us back in the driving seat rather than being in the boot of the car.
But that's empowering. That's not negative. That's powerful, isn't it?
Yes, and for some people, especially if we've developed victim consciousness where it's always poor me, look what they've done to me, look how I'm being treated, those people can tend to get stuck in problem, being problem focused and victim thinking. And it's not to say that some of us haven't been victims, we have. But the power comes from, okay, so what is it? If I keep meeting for idiots, as you said, then what is it that I'm doing that is enabling those people to have access to me? If you can check that, then you have the power to begin to make different choices. And that's where our power lies in our choices.
Okay. I met a new fella some time ago. While we got on, I'm really not connecting with his friends. They appear distant and make constant references to his ex-girlfriend, who, by the way, cheated on him. That is quite, by the way. Any advice on how to connect with them? This is a toughie, isn't it? Because, you know, you're going out with a person. Are you going out with their friends? But you don't want to sort of, I think the worst thing you could do is sort of try and remove a partner from their friendship groups. I don't know. It's a complicated one, this, Keely. I wouldn't like to be unpacking it.
Well, the challenge is, it goes back to that adage, you know, show me your friends and I'll show you who you are. And often we may not like that, and that's understandable. It's something to pay attention to, because though that is their circle. And whilst we shouldn't be encouraging people, you know, we also know an aspect of unhealthy relationships is when someone becomes isolated. So we don't want to be kind of encouraging someone to become isolated. But we do need to be mindful about their network.
I get you. Kitty, there's been a slight interruption there in the signal, but
Yeah, we need to be mindful of their network.
Okay, no, I got that. And the signal, I know from speaking to you in the past, will bounce back, and it will do so while I ask this next question. Hopefully you can hear me. I'm currently going for a mastectomy, and while I've been living together with my partner happily for the last 7 years, I'm worried about how this will change our relationship. We have talked it over and out and up and down, and while he assures me it makes no difference to him, I can't help but worry. Now, I'd say this person has a really good partner and maybe needs to trust what they're saying to them. What do you think, Keely?
I think you need to work out what are the inadequacies that you might be feeling about having the operation. That do you fear abandonment? Do you fear loss of your sexual prowess, your sexuality, desirability? And these are all healthy reactions to have to such a drastic life-saving intervention. You know, on one hand, we gain health, we gain life, but there's an aspect of our identity that will be lost. For some individuals, they may well have reconstructive surgery in time. And so that's understandable. If that's a route somebody chooses to go down, that's not for everybody. It may well be worth having that conversation with a professional if there are any supports that is available to people through that agency to assist with this really difficult transition and what it means to lose, you know, to lose such an important part of our body, what that really means, and the fears and the natural fears and concerns that they have about what that will mean for their sexual relationship, their intimacy.
I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that the person, I think, is lucky that they feel they can have that conversation with a partner. I think a lot of people might go through that whole process and that's all internalized and not really having anyone to speak to. So, I mean, obviously there's a bigger experience ongoing, but I think we talk an awful lot, don't we, Keely, about being able to speak to people and having that type of relationship. It sounds like it's a, if you can have that open, frank conversation about your feelings, I think that's a really good starting point.
I think it's absolutely brilliant that you're able to have an uncomfortable conversation, because this is about us being vulnerable and being conscious about how this may impact on the individual. And so it's something to really pay attention to, because it's likely that there's going to be a down period after a low, slight depression or depression, you know, n naturally, and concerns that potentially I won't be able to fill my partner's needs in a particular way. And that's all good. But also at times to give yourself credit that you have that and you've been reassured. But for example, if you struggle with someone reassuring you and you've still got those fears and it's niggling away at you, what support might be available? You know, and sometimes, for example, if that's to do with cancer, that might come through Macmillan Trust. I know that they have a really robust support network for their clients.
And we're really lucky we have Cancer Care Northwest in this area, which I'm sure would love to hear from that person. I always swore I'd never be the mammy who hated my partner if we split, but he's met someone new and she's lovely to our two daughters, and I can't help but feel jealous when they talk about things that they're doing together. It's like they get the fun time and I get the bedtime and the homework and the rows, the everyday stuff. I think this is a question that's going to resonate with a lot of people. They want to know, how do they stop feeling jealous? And it doesn't seem to be jealousy between their ex-partner and them. It seems to be the relationship, because they're getting all the good stuff, aren't they? Presumably at weekends and what have you. But it's the relationship, I think, that her children are having with this other woman who she says is lovely. How does she stop feeling jealous?
I think our emotion, the jealousy emotion, is healthy. Jealousy is about loss. And so I think, firstly, acknowledge that and don't judge that. Don't condemn your reaction to that, because, like, you've got to deal with the nitty gritty of everyday life. Whilst they have the weekend and might be doing fun activities, it's understandable that you feel that way. The key is, what might that mean that you might need to think about? What might you need to do that might mean that you have, if it's tricky, right? If you're single, you've not got another partner, so your life might feel somewhat stagnant to some degree. And here the kids are off and they're loving them up. There is a blessing in that. You know, we all know trauma stories of having an awful stepmother who chastises. So allow yourself to feel the sadness, allow yourself to feel jealousy. And what might that mean? I think jealousy can be inspiration. What is it that they have that I might want for myself? Yeah. What might I need to be doing? What might I changes might I need to make? And sometimes you can talk with the kids, you know, yes, you have to do the nitty gritty work. But what might they like us to do together to have some fun time, moving just away from survival and the practicals of raising children.
Right, brilliant stuff. Just time for two more, if that's all right, Keely. How do we balance household chores? I don't want to come across as a nag. Not sure if that's coming from a man or a woman.
I am a massive advocate, and I don't always think it is about what you earn, of paying for help. You know, if my hourly rate is 50 quid, and if I'm going to spend 3 hours cleaning, that's £150. Now, for my own wellness and sanity, I would rather pay somebody to assist me. Mm-hmm. Because then it's not a task that is put upon me. I'm then using my time, even though I might have a little tidy up before they come along. So also think about, is this also something that you might contract out, which can seem very indulgent, especially depending on what kind of society, you know, like, can be frowned upon. But I've recommended it to couples. Like, I've seen it actually be beneficial and save marriages. Because especially in the times that we're in, both couples are usually working. And what happens is it falls down to traditional roles of the female can end up doing the kind of domesticated tasks. Now, if that is the case, what might I be able to contract out? And to be unapologetic, I don't buy my own shirts. My mum thinks it's a disgrace. She brought me up better than that. But mum, I'm not going to spend my Sunday evenings like I watched you do for years, ironing for 4 hours. I'm just not going to do it.
I love the attitude. But what if you can't afford that, though, when it does fall down to splitting the chores within the household, though?
Well, I think if you can't afford that, that's the value of having, you know, giving away responsibilities, creating rotas, so that somebody else, you know, so that you make it clear. I think we also need to be mindful that sometimes we need to let it crash. So if somebody doesn't do it and you moan and then you go and do it, then you're making a rod for your own back, you know, so that you begin to set boundaries. But boundaries also need consequence. So if they don't do it and then you jump in, what are we really telling people?
But the person doesn't want to be a skivvy. So it's unsustainable. They are going to have to come up with a solution to this, because they clearly don't want to spend their life as a skivvy. you know, doing the housework. So they're going to have to figure it out, or going to have the conversation, because that will eat away in time. Last one, if you don't mind. And I think there's a lot of hope for this listener. I'm in my early 40s. Where do I go from here? They say life starts at 40, but it's not easy to find someone in your 40s. Have you any advice?
I would really actively encourage you to get out there and do things. This swipe into the left, swipe into the right. Yeah, it has its place, but I think we've forgotten the old adage of try something new, get some tap dancing shoes, a bit of Zumba, something where you are pursuing an interest, getting out of your comfort zone, whereas you are much more likely to meet different people.
Yeah, and there's lots and lots of people. Recently saw a statistics, which I can't pull straight off the top of my head, but far more single people in this country that I'm speaking to you from than I anticipated. There's lots and lots of people that are looking for the same thing. It's just a case of those two people coming together.
Absolutely. And like I said, we kind of live in this illusion that we get on the phone, we get on the apps, and actually we've forgotten some of the old school stuff. You know, some of my clients, they do meetup.com, and then they do cinema trips, they do lunch trips. I'm a massive advocate and fan of that. I'm a real fan of getting out there rather than just purely relying. What do you like? What do you enjoy? Pursue that.
And also, too, you cut through all the crap of people just looking for a hookup, just looking for someone to, you know what I mean? You get rid of all that. I would hate to be on an app trying to figure out, you know, someone's motives. And I think it's actually worse, perhaps, for dealing with fellas than it might be dealing with women. But Keely, listen, as always, it's been lovely having you on the show. Keely Taverner is a psychotherapist, author and coach. Now, Keely is obviously UK-based, because I said, but also you do a lot of your work remotely. And why not, actually? There's no issue Absolutely. With that. So if anyone wants any further information, Keely?
Keyforchange.com.
Lovely stuff, spelt both ways. Take care of yourself, Keely. God bless. Thank you very much indeed. Now, we're joined on the programme by Eamon O'Hara, who wrote a piece in the Irish Times calling for government to take accountability for misinformation. We thought we'd dig in a little bit deeper to those disinformation. We thought we'd dig in a little bit here more with this, with Eamon. Eamon, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg, and thanks for having me on the show. John and Marie rang me there the other day about coming on to you here.
Yeah, no, we appreciate you accepting the invite. Okay, so give us the thrust of the point you were making in your piece, your letter, Eamon.
Yeah, well, I suppose it was in the Independent there, I think it was Tuesday past. Basically, I suppose we hear a lot, you know, sort of buzzwords at the minute with misinformation and disinformation. You know, the government would be, and rightly so, as I said in my letter, they call out people and organisations that, I suppose, aren't telling the full truth, you know. But the thrust of the letter was about the government with disinformation. You know, and as you know, disinformation is deliberately spreading false information, you know. It's a slightly different, as you know, than misinformation. But the letter was in regard to disinformation. But it was basically about the recent referendum, you know, about the government not accepting the not stating that they got... advice from the Attorney General in relation to the durable relationships and the family referendum. And I mean, they were asked on several occasions, you know, government ministers, if they had any information to that would prove difficult if the referendum was passed. And I suppose it was leaked the day before the referendum that basically the advice they got was like that this durable relationships.
It effectively echoed what opposing a yes was saying, really, if the truth be told.
Yeah. So that was basically the thrust of the letter. So basically what I was saying was, I mean, I have no issue with the government calling out misinformation, disinformation, if they see fit. But, I mean, they should practice what they preach themselves was basically what the letter was about, you know.
But the issue we have, Eamon, and I think, you know, disinformation, misinformation, wherever it may come from, I don't think is very useful. But the whole conversation really that needs to be had is that who is the judge and the jury in relation to this? Who judges what is disinformation or what is misinformation? A lot of the public, not just in this country and others, actually don't trust the government of the day to be the people who, like, I'll give you an example. Recently, it was announced in January, it was announced that areas that got more immigrants than other areas would get this windfall of millions of euro. I said at the time,
yeah,
what? How does that work? Yeah. How would that even work? Blah, 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 blah. 2 months later, it's unworkable. It's not happened and it can't happen. Yeah. Now, I don't know if that's misinformation or disinformation, but that was released at a time where there was a peak in sort of anti-immigration feeling, right?
Yeah.
So was that disingenuously released? Was it a mistake?
Yeah.
Did someone, you know, so who is actually going to judge what is misinformation and what is disinformation? I don't trust the social media companies, and I'm not sure really we should have to trust the elected government of any country to do that. Do you have that concern, Eamon?
Well, that is true. Yes, but I mean the government. I mean, if the, you know, if they're sort of saying, you know, some certain things are not true or whatever. Basically, at least they should be leading by example themselves if they're trying to call out organisations that are, you know, like you mentioned immigration there, Greg. If I have time, have I got time to mention to you something? Another example.
Go ahead.
you were talking about immigration there, but just in relation to immigration, we hear a lot of. Now, I'm not advocating, I'm just giving you an example. I'm not saying that of government disinformation again. Basically, you know, the government has sort of said that we have to, we have duties under international law to accept refugees, which of course is true, that's correct. But they're saying that we can't limit the amount of refugees that are coming into the country, but that actually is disinformation because there is a clause in the Lisbon Treaty that the Irish people voted on. Basically, Ireland and Denmark in that treaty had an opt-out clause in relation to migration
in a way, though, I could say really that to some extent you're spreading disinformation because the government has, I know, because I've heard them, accepted that and are actually now pursuing the option of paying a third country to take immigrants coming into Ireland. So, in a way... If I didn't say what I just said to counter what you said, you could have been accused of spreading dis or misinformation.
Well, I suppose that you could look at it that way, Greg. But my point is, the government has never come out and said, like, the government has never come out and said that we have this clause under the Lisbon Treaty that, like, the only two countries that has it is Ireland and Denmark. Denmark already in 2021 have invoked it, you know, and they're basically have sending. Refugees to a third country. But you know, my point is for them to come on the radio and television and to local people and say that they have no choice, that is not entirely correct.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get.
They've no choice because they signed up to that. But the choice had already been made.
So that's my point. I mean, they shouldn't be coming on television or radio saying we have no choice but to accept. Like, I understand totally. Of course, we have rights, we have obligations under EU law and international law and all that. I understand all that. But for a politician to come out and say we have no choice but to take whatever amount of refugees that... Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't take them or we should take them. The point I'm making is that for them to come out and say that we have no choice but to take them, that is actually incorrect. Do you know what I'm trying to get at?
No, I hear what you're saying, but you see, the problem is you could challenge everything, right? So let's just say a lot of, and we'll not dig too deep into this, but let's just say a lot of the plaudits on Leo Varadkar today are saying how he and the government got this country back on their feet post-pandemic. Now, that's all well and good, and you could make that argument, but it also should be noted, should it not, that the average debt per person, babies, woman, men, they,
yes,
them, whatever it might be
country,
now,
yeah,
is at 42,000 euro per person,
which
has gone up multiple thousands, okay? So really, the cost of thanking the government that got us back on our feet, right, is the fact that we and generation and the next generation and the generation of that are actually going to have to pay. So I think that should be challenged to say, well, did we do really well coming out of COVID? Because our grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to have to pay the price. Ireland has the highest gross, one of the highest gross of public debts in the world at just over 42,000 per person. So I'm with you. Even what seems like a legitimate statement very easily could and should be challenged, one could argue, Eamon.
Yeah. Well, you see, as you know yourself, you know, the government had a lot of these, shall we say, spin doctors, for want of a better word. But a lot of the time, as you know, well, I mean, it goes on in every country, but a lot of the time, like, these spin doctors are only there to put the government's spin, shall we say, on things which might not be correct in what they're saying either, you know. And I mean, I suppose all the government has to do to sow doubt in the electorate's mind is to say something that something that another person has said isn't true, and that sort of puts, I suppose, doubts in people's minds, you know. It's just like, just in relation to the referendum, it's not people saying then that, like, as you know, the care referendum that was the highest ever in the country, the no vote, but like. The opposition parties, apart from me and two now, but the opposition parties were for a yes vote too. But they did come out and say that the wording wasn't, satisfactory.
That should have been a no-no.
Requested a yes vote. But, I mean, if the opposition wasn't happy with the wording, surely they should have said that they wanted people to vote no, because, I mean, I would have took if they were asking people to vote yes. So just for argument's sake, Greg would say the referendums were passed and with a yes vote. So obviously it wouldn't have been good enough for them. Mm-hmm. So the electorate would have to be asked again at some time in the future.
But does the outcome of that referendum, though, not prove that we are the best filters of ourselves of mis and disinformation, in that the public, the absolute majority of those that were motivated to vote says, right, you've said this. You're not releasing the information from the Attorney General, but we've done our research and we are of the view that we don't really buy what you're selling. So in a way, are we not doing okay because we're seeing through it ourselves? If it should exist.
It showed me, and I don't know what other people's opinions are, but it showed me the government that they think so little in a way of the Constitution that they just said we'll throw out any sort of a word and for want of a better word, and so we'll just tell the people to vote yes for it. And then, all the opposition parties apart from Aintu went along with it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And advocated a yes vote. I mean, there was very few people. I mean, there was a few, Paddy Tobin, Michael Tobin, or Michael McDougall, Tom Clune, and a few of those, but a few senators and TDs, very, you know, independent ones. But there was the vast majority of the NGOs were advocating for a yes vote too, you know. And I mean, the irony to me was that they wanted to get rid of, you know, mothers and that from the Constitution. But they actually had this just shows how out of touch the government is, really. They had the vote on International Women's Day. So they were asking women and men to vote to delete an article to women in the Constitution.
One of the selling points was that the language was sexist and not inclusive.
Yeah.
That really offended a lot of mothers, a lot of women, and a lot of people that support them too. They're like, no, it's not sexist. Women do play a very important role in women's lives. The mother is very, very important.
Yes, definitely, Greg. And the thing I was really surprised about, now I am going to mention one organisation, but it's just an organisation that was very prominent in the campaign, was the National Women's Council. Now, I know there was other NGOs as well, but it's just one that sort of comes to mind to me. Like, the National Women's Council obviously is a council for women, but they were advocating this too, and I couldn't understand that, because an organisation that, you know, that looks after women's rights or promotes them, surely to God they shouldn't be looking for a deletion of women from I think it even goes a little bit beyond that.
A group that claims to represent a group of individuals being so out of touch with the individuals that they represent, you might say, well, if they got this so wrong, what else are they getting so wrong? So I think, you know, I don't think that should be parked, that point. I think organisations like that do have a lot of questions to answer as to how they come up with their positions on certain things. You know, yeah. How do you, I mean, if you're not speaking, if you're clearly not speaking as a voice and the voice of the group you claim to represent, well, then you sort of have to say, well, how are you coming up with your decisions? How are you formulating your opinions? How are you representing the views of the people you claim to represent?
Exactly. And just when you're on that point, Greg, just another organisation just comes to my mind now. So one of the family, I'm not sure which one it was now, but one of the carers organisations, they were on that upfront programme the Monday after the referendum. And one of the women that was involved with the organisation came out and said on air that the actual people weren't consulted. The people in the organisation weren't consulted on whether they went which way they were going to vote in the referendum, you know. So there was a carers organisation too that were basically saying for people to vote yes, but didn't consult their members. I mean, you couldn't make it up. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
You know, and that was all on air. I have reservations too, and I mean, the government, irrespective of what the vote was, I mean, some of them could have had, the decency to even turn up at Dublin Castle when the results were being announced. And know what the word, you mean, the ran for cover. I mean, if it was a yes vote, they would have been tripping across one another.
It is our constitution. I mean, outside of a general election, it's either on a par or as just behind the importance. Eamon, it's been really interesting. Thanks for coming on and teasing out your views a bit further with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for that, Greg.
Jordan Mooney of Rockwell Financial joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks a million for having me on.
No, it's great to have you on. Right, what way are interest rates going to go this year, do you think? No, I mean, now, obviously, I can't see you at this moment, but I presume you don't have a crystal ball or tarot cards, but maybe I know you have an informed opinion. So what way do you think things are going to go?
Well, you did take the words out of my mouth, Greg. I suppose I don't have a crystal ball with regards to how they're going to go, but there is whispers with regards to them potentially coming down. Now, the reason interest rates went up in the first place was to kind of combat inflation. So obviously, everybody's kind of obviously going mad about the price of everything shooting up and skyrocketing. And what governments do in order to combat that is they'll increase interest rates so everything will come back down, so money will become more expensive. Now, again, inflation is starting to come down, so there's whispers of interest rates obviously coming down as well to kind of match that. Now, again, what kind of people will see here is potentially things like car loans, home improvement loans will start to come.
Yep, Jordan, are you there? Okay, yeah, go
things
ahead.
Like
sorry,
mortgages,
just, we dropped out there.
It's hard to say if those will come down immediately.
Yep. Sorry, Jordan, you were saying pick up from car loans and what have you, because you dropped out just briefly there.
Yeah, no, so I suppose with regards to it, Greg, things like car loans and home improvement loans and credit card debt, again, those have become cheaper for people to actually take out those loans. But things like mortgages might necessarily come down immediately. Those are typically a lot slower to decrease.
And talking, I note to listening to some of the spokespeople for the pillar banks, that they're already sort of, I think, trying to prepare the public for what you're talking about there, because they're saying that, you know, whilst they were much higher than the rest of Europe or much of Europe for a time, Europe did come up a bit quicker than we did. And they're sort of saying that, you know, they didn't pass on any increase, although it was from a higher level. And that then, the they can't guarantee that any interest rate cuts then will be passed back to the consumer. So they're covering themselves, I think, for this year anyway.
Yeah, not exactly, Greg. And I think from the perspective, people should also understand that Ireland 2 or 3 years ago was probably one of the most expensive countries in Europe to actually have a mortgage. Now we're somewhere in the middle with regards to how expensive we are to have a mortgage. To think that they drop interest rates, that we'd be one of the lowest countries in Europe to have a mortgage, I don't know, would I be putting my hat on that now, to be honest with you, Greg. Things might just stay the same with regards to interest rates. Interest rates still in comparison to 20 years ago, like our average rate is around 4.25% at the minute. 20 years ago, it was up at 12% in 2004. So again, they still are relatively low.
If there is a European-wide drop in interest rates and it's not necessarily passed on to existing mortgage holders as quickly as we might like, often we do see the banks sort of trying to target first-time buyers or new mortgage customers. Do you think we might see more competitive rates in that area more quickly?
Yeah, and I think a huge thing, Greg, recently in the last few years is green mortgage rates. So if you have a BER, which is your energy rating, of B3 or higher, typically you'll qualify for what's known as a green energy rating. So again, your house is a lot more robust and warm and sustainable. So in that sense, banks will actually offer you a lower interest rate based on that. So again, I think the best green rate at the moment is with Bank of Ireland at 3.6%.
Obviously, there was a lot of talk of fixing when we were sort of at the bottom of the upward curve, if we could describe it at that, as that, you know, maybe still people are still on variables or whatever it might be. Hopefully no one locked into to too high a fixed rate. But is there any argument at the moment for looking at your interest rate fixing or what?
Well, Greg, I suppose from an affordability perspective, I think that's the most important thing people should take into consideration. If you're on a rate of, say, 3.6 to 3.9, and you find it's very affordable for you and your family, and you're happy with that rate going forward, there's nothing bad about locking in for that rate for a prolonged period of time. From a budget perspective, at least you know and you're consistently happy that your rate will stay the same, because they're not anything saying in the future that rates won't go up either. So I think it's very important to bear that in mind as well. So people need to take into consideration things like affordability from an importance of how long they should be locking in for as well. Now, again, as I said, if you look back historically, rates are still really, really low. So again, it's not the worst thing ever to lock in for a kind of prolonged period.
And I really feel for those with the vulture funds with mortgages that have seen them skyrocket. Will they come down at all? We don't know. What is the story with tracker mortgages? I mean, I think people still on a tracker. It's not the attractive proposition, I don't think. Jordan, correct me if I'm wrong, as it once was. But people on tracker mortgages might be keeping a closer eye on variations in interest rates, particularly downwards now at this point.
100%, Greg. So with regards to the tracker rate, just to kind of reiterate, that is in line with the European Central Bank rate of interest, and that will fall if the European Central Bank decrease their rates. Okay, so those people are going to be highly affected by this if rates do decrease. So they're kind of sitting on the fence now for a period, because they historically would have had a good few years of really, really low interest rates and have been fantastic for those people. And then suddenly over the last 2 years, they've almost skyrocketed. So again, a lot of people are sitting on the fence whether they should come off their tracker and go on to a long-term fixed rate or remain on their tracker and see what happens. And again, when we're talking to clients, Greg, it's always a conversation of affordability. Mm, and, you know, if the mortgages become unaffordable for them, they should look elsewhere if they're happy enough trying to wait it out and see if it goes down.
And finally, is the tracker mortgage a product? Still, I don't mean for existing customers, but offered to new customers, or is that a thing of the past?
No, not necessarily. So with regards to it, what typically is vast majority of first-time buyers are going on to fixed rates typically, okay? Because again, they're getting onto the market for the first time and they want to kind of have a fixed rate. Variable rates as well are offered to clients as well. But again, typically those are the two you're going to find. You'll have your fixed rate and your variable rate, and those will vary depending on the years that you want to take them out for.
Brilliant stuff, Jordan. Thank you very much indeed. Jordan Mooney of Rockwell Finance. And you can Google that company if you want to speak to Jordan and the team a little further on that type of stuff. I was chatting yesterday to a lovely lady from Moville who was trying to raise awareness of colon cancer. And hers was a very interesting story. I'd encourage you to listen back to it yesterday. It's on the podcast, or you can watch it on our socials. She went to the GP initially, and because she was bleeding when she was wiping. She went to the GP initially, put it down to piles, sent her home, but the little voice in her head said, "No, there's something else going on here." She went back and was sent them for a colonoscopy and was told there and then it was a tumour. It turned out to be cancerous. Thankfully, she's doing really well in her recovery. And then we were contacted by two or three people yesterday with the same experience. And this listener says, exact same thing happened. My mum wasn't happy that she was dismissed and my dad told her to go back and make them do something. And after that, they ran bloods and something showed up. And from there on, she was diagnosed and is now 10 years ago. She's flying, but without that second push, probably wouldn't be here today. And the interesting thing with our listener yesterday is that her cancer didn't show up in her bloods or in her stool. It only showed up when they tested the tumour stroke polyps. So again, just another reminder to double check that. But if you really should listen to that interview yesterday. I want to say we mentioned the badminton teams from Royal and Priory yesterday. I've got more details from that. Congratulations to the three badminton teams from Royal and Priory Riffle who won Division 1 All-Ireland titles yesterday. Under 19 boys, under 14 boys, under 14 girls. What an achievement. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. Okay, fantastic. Right, that's where we have to leave it on the show today. Remarkably, it's Friday tomorrow, which means we have our Friday panel. That's entertainment and so much more besides. So please rejoin us at 9 o'clock. But for me, Greg Hughes, Caroline Orr, who's back researching and producing the show after a short break, and Shannon working on the show as well. Have a great Thursday.